WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
David Cronenberg makes horror movies about the mind and the body it is trapped in. His 1986 remake of The Fly starred Jeff Goldblum as a scientist who slowly turns into a giant insect as a result of an experiment gone wrong. Scanners is about people who are born telepathic and are driven crazy by the constant noise of other people's thoughts. Parasites are sexually transmitted in his film They Came From Within. Cronenberg's other movies include Videodrome, Rabid, The Brood, and The Dead Zone, which was adapted from a Stephen King novel. David Cronenberg is a Canadian filmmaker who writes most of the movies he directs. He co-wrote and directed his latest film, Dead Ringers, which stars Jeremy Irons and Genevieve Bugeaud. It just came out on home video. In Dead Ringers, Jeremy Irons plays two roles, identical twin gynecologists. The brothers fall in love with the same woman, and they fool her into thinking that she's involved with only one man. The twins' physical and emotional closeness leads to their undoing. In this scene, one of the brothers has become a barbiturate addict. His twin is trying to prevent him from taking more sleeping pills.
I can't sleep. If you're asking me for sleep, I'll tell you right now, you're not going to get one.
But what am I going to do then?
You'll stay up.
I'll die if I don't sleep.
You'll stay up.
What if I take something when you go home?
I'm staying right here.
What if I take something when you go to sleep?
I won't go to sleep.
How do you stay awake?
I'll take something.
You'll take an up so that I don't take a down. This is crazy.
Bev, don't worry about me. I'm not you.
David Cronenberg, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thanks very much.
In Dead Ringers, what were some of the physical and psychological connections that interested you in the story of twin doctors, of twins?
Well, I think I'm always very interested in our relationship to our own bodies, and I think twins immediately makes you deal with that question. Most of us take our understanding of ourselves as individuals, as unique from what we are physically. We don't look exactly like anybody else. We don't sound exactly like anybody else. And that's where we begin when we think of the identity. But if you imagine, of course, that you had someone walking around with you most of the time who looked exactly like you, sounded like you, thought very much like you, and was someone whom other people confused for you often, it forces you then to look someplace else for what is the essence of identity, what is the real I. And that's one of the things that attracted me to the subject of twins in the first place. That's that kind of schism. You've got two bodies exactly the same.
Well, you're directing one actor in both of those roles, Jeremy Irons, and you had to figure out subtle physical and vocal differences.
Yes.
To cue the audience about which character was speaking at each time.
Yeah.
How did you work that out with Irons about the different vocal and physical qualities each character would take on?
Basically, I mean, at first we weren't sure how far to go. That was really the scary part, was how different should we make them? How we didn't want to go too far. And we really sort of felt our way towards it. I mean, at one point Jeremy asked if he could have two dressing rooms, one for each character. And he wasn't kidding, because it just in order to keep, he needed to keep them separate himself, because the film was shot in the normal filmic way, which is to say very much out of sequence.
Both of these gynecologists are in love with the same woman, an actress played by Genevieve Bugeaud. And through a gynecological exam, they find out that she has a deformed uterus. She has three cervixes. So one of the gynecologists, while he's having an emotional breakdown, creates this set of surgical instruments to work on women with deformed insides. And I want to play a little clip about that. I should say that these surgical tools really look like tools of mutilation and torture. Let's hear the clip.
Seems to be some problem about surgical instruments, but holding them as evidence of a disturbed mind.
Do you know what they're talking about?
I tried to tell you, Ellie. You just don't know the kind of patients you've been getting lately. I don't know what's going on out there.
Patients are getting strange. They look all right on the outside, but their insides
deformed.
Well, I had to deal with it somehow. Radical technology was required.
You're right, Bev. Something radical is definitely required.
That's Jeremy Irons in both roles, both of those doctor roles. And this is in a lot of ways a gynecological horror film.
Yes, I think it's true. I mean, when I tried to get this movie set up at various studios, I was often asked, well, do they have to be gynecologists? Can't they be lawyers or something? And I said, well, if you think they could be lawyers, then you really don't understand what this movie is about. It does deal with the relationships between men and women and the power structures that exist in society between men and women.
Well, you get at something that I don't think many men think about, which is how uncomfortable, what a loss of control you experience, what a feeling of violation you experience when you're a woman getting an internal examination. And you have some pretty horrifying scenes related to that. And I was wondering what interested you as a man in that kind of gynecological horror.
Well, I think, when you're writing, you do have to become your characters for the moment that you're writing them. And whether they're men or women, whether they're old or whatever, you really have to be prepared to get into their skins. And that's really that's when I become an actor, is when I'm writing, actually. And that's when I have to psych myself in to whatever my characters might be feeling.
Well, speaking of becoming an actor, you acted the role of the gynecologist in The Fly. It was you who delivers the maggot baby during the abortion nightmare. Why did you cast yourself as the gynecologist?
Well, it was actually very pragmatic. I'm not really into homages to anybody, including myself, and I'm not really into the sort of Hitchcock put yourself in your own movie kind of thing. Well, we did have an actor, actually was one of the producers of the show. I had wanted to cast him as that doctor, and he really basically got cold feet at the last minute. He wasn't sure he could do it. He got very nervous, and I was the only one around.
Right, okay.
It's as simple as that. I have to say also that when Martin Scorsese met me, he told me later that he had been afraid to meet me because of my movies, which he liked very much, but he said scared him very much.
Uh-huh.
And he was terrified that I would be some strange, bizarre kind of person. This is the guy who made Taxi Driver, you understand. And he said to me, when I walked in, he said he was relieved to see that I was a guy who looked more or less like a Beverly Hills gynecologist. So I thought, well, Marty is very good at casting. If he thinks I could play that role, maybe I should do it. I have to say, though, for Dead Ringers, I needed an actor who was a lot better than I am. So I didn't think about it.
Right. My guest is screenwriter and film director David Cronenberg, and his new film is called Dead Ringers. Jeremy Irons plays the role of twin gynecologists. Cronenberg's other films include The Fly, Scanners, Videodrome, and The Dead Zone. Your films deal with, I think of your films almost as parables about disease and about the mind-body split, about contagion. And some of these issues are things that people write, philosophy books about, that the great philosophers sit and talk about. You've chosen the horror genre for most of your movies, but you're really dealing with pretty serious issues, and you're dealing with them frequently in a very, very ironically funny way. And I wonder why you've chosen the horror genre to take on matters of real consequence.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think there's a sort of a perverse element in any artist. You don't want to. I mean, you wouldn't become an artist of any kind if you were worried about being in the mainstream. You already are a bit of an outsider if you choose to that profession, or if in fact that chooses you. So, it was very natural for me to start writing horror films because I like the kind of inventing that you could do. It's understood that you're not dealing with what most people think of as documentary reality when you do a horror film. So you're free to invent your own science, invent your own creatures, invent your own universe, really. And I enjoyed that. It was very exciting. Also, you are immediately plugging into, as you've pointed out, some very heavy stuff. I mean, you are talking, the true subject of all horror films, is as far as I'm concerned, is death.
Uh-huh.
And you are dealing with death, you're dealing with aging, separation, the question of is there an afterlife or not. It's fairly heavy, and it's very direct. There's no fooling around with a horror film. It's really, so those combinations of things, I think, are what really attract me to the genre. And I think Although Dead Ringers, I guess I wouldn't technically call a horror film. It's not like The Fly in the sense that there's not a lot of rubber, you know, not a lot of special effects. Still, I would agree that the tone of it is horrific, and the themes do connect with everything else I've done. It just seems very, I draw a lot of strength and power and energy from the genre itself.
Well, you get to some really interesting themes in your remake of The Fly, and mm-hmm. it's about a scientist who does an experiment, but in the experiment he splices his genes with those of a fly, and he slowly starts transforming into a fly, and he sees his transformation as a cancer-like disease that he has no control over. I want to play a clip from this, and this is Jeff Goldblum as the scientist turning into a fly, and Gina Davis as his lover.
I seem to be stricken by a disease with a purpose, wouldn't you say? Maybe not such a bad disease after all.
I can't stay.
No, no, no. Why not? Why can't you?
I can't take it. It's too much.
That's what it takes. The disease has just revealed its purpose. We don't have to worry about contagion anymore. I know what the disease wants.
What does the disease want?
It wants to turn me into something else. That's not too terrible, is it? Most people would give anything to be turned into something else.
Turned into what?
What do you think, a fly? By becoming a 185-pound fly? No, I'm becoming something that never existed before. I'm becoming Brundlefly. Don't you think that's worth a Nobel Prize or two?
You get so much into that movie. Part of what's in that scene is seeing someone who you really love being totally transformed by this, ravaged by this uncontrollable disease, and it disgusts mm-hmm. you, but you love the person, and do yes. you leave because it disgusts you, or do you stay? How do you deal yeah. with it?
Yeah, well, that's the thing. I mean, although the premise is very sci-fi, the emotional reality of it, I think, is lived every day by many, many people around the world. I mean, for me, in a sense, the movie was really about aging at its most basic. The idea that every love affair is a tragic love affair because of the inevitability of death and separation. So that's really where that movie draws a lot of its emotional power from.
It's also a horror film about looking in the mirror, thinking
yes.
like, oh, I look like that. That's disgusting. There's one scene where when Jeff Goldblum is turning into the fly, he's looking at the mirror, just absolutely disgusted with what he sees. He throws his razor against the wall, and then he picks up his hand, and he starts picking at his fingernails, and they just come off.
Yeah.
He just peels his fingernails off.
Yes.
And I don't know about you. I've had a lot of dreams like that. Do your fingernails ever come off in your dreams?
No, not in my dreams, but I do. I mean, I'm aware that most debilitating diseases begin with something relatively minor and small, but somehow very potently significant. A lot of people found that scene the hardest scene to take in the movie, and it was very minor in terms of special effects. He was actually biting his nails the way people do when they're nervous, and it comes off in his mouth. It's scary, and it's a portent of things to come, of course. And what it really suggests is how fragile we are, how fragile what we are in terms of the integrity of our bodies and our person. You know, we sometimes feel very invulnerable. Those are very nice moments. But just the slightest thing that's off, and you know that you know that everything can come apart on you.
Have you ever been struck with a serious illness where you had to face the kind of debilitation that you describe in The Fly?
Not yet.
Well, I'm glad.
Me too. Very glad.
I actually was reading an article where your sister was quoted as saying that she thought that movie was influenced a lot by you and she having to watch your parents die very slowly of debilitating mm-hmm. illnesses.
Well, I think she's wrong really about that, in the sense that I've been making movies that dealt with that subject when my parents were very healthy.
Uh-huh.
I think that's really more her own emotional projection than mine. But I think, you know, you don't have to actually have it happen to you to have empathy for it, you know?
You know what I love, though? You're able to take these really heavy, morbid subjects and inject this great humor in it, like when Jeff Goldblum in The Fly says, "I won't be just another tumorous bore."
Yes. Well, and it's the same in Dead Ringers. I mean, I don't think I could make a movie without some humor, because one of the wonderful things about the way humans deal with the universe as it's given to them is through humor. I mean, that's a way that you can diffuse things or gain some control over them. And when my characters are in trouble, they tend to get very funny.
Let's go back a few years to one of your earlier films, Scanners. And I think this was your first film to actually really get some commercial play in the United States.
Yeah, and it actually was the number one film the weekend that it opened, which was quite a surprise since it was a very relatively low-budget picture that was coming from a small distributor.
The film is about baby boomers who are now in their mid-30s. And they were born telepathic because of an experimental drug administered to their mothers during pregnancy. But the telepathy becomes an affliction because they can't control it and they can't turn it off. So when they walk by people, they're always reading their minds. And their own minds are just invaded by the voices of others. How did you come up with that? It just seems to me like the perfect metaphor for those of us who feel totally overwhelmed and inundated by information.
Sure. Sure, and even as you say that, I realize that one of the themes of Scanners was also identity. You know, how can you find your own mind when you have so many other minds speaking in your head? And that does connect very directly to sort of the themes of Dead Ringers. It's very difficult for me to say where these things come from. It feels very tangible to me, but when I sit down and start to write, I have no idea what's going to come up out of the typewriter. It's very mysterious. You know, sometimes the film will start for me with an image, a dream, a line of dialogue, a character. It can come from anywhere.
Was there an image or a dream that kicked off Scanners?
I really can't remember how that started.
Okay.
I really can't.
There's a scene where one of the people who is telepathic and can't get the voices out of his head explains why he drilled a hole in his head to
yes.
let out the voices. And I'll tell you, whenever I have a really bad headache, I think of that scene.
Well, I remember in the 60s there were a couple of instances of people who did drill holes in their forehead. It had more to do with the idea of the third eye and so on, but they all did seem to speak of it as a relief of pressure, and they weren't speaking of physical pressure. I think they were speaking of psychic pressure, and as you mentioned that, it recurs to me that when people ask me about what the process of showing one of my films is to me, I realize now that I often speak of it as though a hole were drilled in someone's forehead so that their dreams could be projected directly onto a screen and with people watching. And I've actually never made that connection before, but of course it does connect very directly with that image in Scanners.
It's a great image. There's a scene where an artist is tracked down, who's one of these telepathic guys, and he makes sculptures of giant heads, which is the perfect art for someone
right.
who's lost in their head to be making. I want to play a clip from that scene. One scanner who can't control his voices has tracked down this artist. Here we go.
It's the voices in my head. They're driving me crazy. How do you stop them? Your voices.
My art. My art keeps me sane.
What a great scene. You could tell that artist isn't particularly sane at all.
That's right. It isn't working, is it?
Well, does your art keep you sane?
Well, I don't know, because I haven't been without it for a long time, but I have a feeling that it's a very necessary part of my nervous system to be able to do what I do. I don't think of it in very psychotherapeutic terms. I think, you know, the idea of psychoanalyzing artists and art is, I think, really begs the question of what art is and what the purpose of it is. But at the same time, I suppose it's like being a great athlete and never getting to run or play basketball or whatever it is that you do. It's certainly going to be frustrating and certainly make you feel that something that you were meant to do is not being allowed to be done.
But I wonder if it keeps you sane or drives you crazy to always be making movies about the things that disturb you the most.
Oh, it doesn't drive me crazy at all. I think it is very, it makes me feel actually that I'm coming to terms with it somehow, that I'm, you know, I mean, one of the reasons that people create is to give them the illusion that they have control over their lives and maybe other people's lives. You know, you can go back to your little garret and start writing novels with thousands of characters, and you're controlling them all. You know, now you know at the same time it's an illusion, but it's somehow comforting to think that you can do that.
Speaking with screenwriter and film director David Cronenberg, one of the things that you're well known for is the special effects in your movies and scanners. When someone's brain is being scanned, when they're being telepathically picked, their head can explode from the pressure of it. And there's in one of the opening scenes, some guy's head just explodes over the room. So I should ask you how you pulled that off in the film.
That particular one was pretty interesting because we tried to be very sophisticated. Of course, we were part of the trick, of course, is in the editing. Yeah. But in terms of the actual head, we had several heads made that were very elaborate. They really had skulls and skin and brains and things. But when we tried to explode them by putting a charge inside the head, the fluids there would just vaporize and you'd get steam. You couldn't see anything. We eventually just blew the head with a shotgun.
Oh, really?
Yeah, the special effects guy was lying on the floor behind the chair, and he just used a shotgun to explode the head.
Yeah, but wasn't there a real person underneath the fake head?
No, God, no.
Oh, good. I should hope not. Otherwise, it would be like William Tell or something.
No, that actor has gone on to be very successful in Canada with his own TV series. He wouldn't have been if he had been under that head, I can assure you. The thing that drives me crazy, just as an aside, is that often a photo purporting to be the photo of on set of that head exploding is printed. In fact, in the magazine I think that you were referring to before, they do print a photo. It's a sort of a stuntman with a kind of sparkler on his head. No one has ever actually printed a photo of the real head from the movie, and it's actually a fantastic shot. It's one of those shots that just by some miracle works out perfectly every frame. It's very surreal. I mean, it really looks like a Dali painting or something, frame by frame, because his face sort of unfolds. It still has a startled expression on it, even as it's coming apart. It's really quite phenomenal.
Well, if I remember correctly, that part of the scene is cut out when it's shown on television in the United States.
Well, it depends. I mean, certainly on pay TV, you see the movie, if it's ever shown on pay TV, I don't know. But yeah, I was required to shoot a TV version in which that character has a heart attack instead of having his head blown up. But in a way, that's really more grotesque and awful because you really get to watch this guy as he suffers. And I find that that's always the way it works with censorship. People who try to control what you do end up having exactly the opposite effect. They make things much, much worse.
Is censorship a subject you've been forced to give a lot of thought to?
Yes, because in Canada we still have forms of censorship that would be quite illegal and unconstitutional in the U.S. And I have had the misfortune to be to have a film, The Brood, censored by the Ontario Censor Board. And this is a group of people who sit in a back room, look at your movies, and cut them physically. I mean, they actually physically cut every print themselves and keep the little pieces. And if you want the film to be shown in Ontario, and usually that means the rest of Canada, you have to submit to this. You have nothing to say about it. You don't have the choice of withdrawing it as you do here. It's very totalitarian, and it's an aspect of Canadian life that I really despise, and I've been working with various groups against it for years and years.
Well, you are a Canadian filmmaker, and Canada is always so anxious to have Canadian artists represented to the world, but I wonder if they think that you're not what they had in mind.
Well, certainly, I mean, another Marty Scorsese story. I mean, in the early days when he was apparently trying to get in touch with me, of course, I was delighted later when I heard that he actually liked my films because I admired him so much. But he came to Toronto in the early days of the Toronto Film Festival, and they said to him, well, Mr. Scorsese, is there any Canadian filmmaker that you'd like to meet? And he said, yeah, there's this guy David Cronenberg. And they kind of hemmed and hawed and said, well, he's not really in town very much. Sure, there's nobody else you'd rather meet? And he never got to meet me that time around. Since then, it's gone quite the opposite direction. I can tell Dead Ringers was the gala presentation which opened the Toronto Film Festival.
Oh.
There were speeches by the Minister of Culture about how wonderful I was. And that's almost more scary, you know, because I think you don't want to get too well-liked and you don't want to get too establishment. I mean, you really don't want to lose the edge to your work and start to worry about how lovable you are. And, you know, I think it's a balance. You know, you need to be an outsider. You need to remain outside up to a certain point anyway. Things have definitely changed in Canada, though. There's no question about that.
I just have one last question for you. Some of your early films had to do with contagion, fear of catching disease, of catching germs or parasites or little monsters. Are you especially afraid of that yourself?
No, it's interesting. I mean, shivers, which in the States was called They Came Within, From Within, has been called the sort of the first sort of prophetic AIDS movie, because it is, in fact, about a very virulent venereal disease that spreads rapidly. But in fact, in those movies, I'm almost doing that sort of writing, acting trick again. I'm saying, what is it like to be a disease? I mean, I'm trying to play the role of the disease. After all, a virus that invades your body is just doing what it's designed to do. I mean, it's fulfilling its own destiny by destroying you. I'm really trying to come to terms with the way nature works and the way the world works. I'm not really particularly a disease paranoid at all.
I never thought of the viruses as having found an ally in you.
Well, I try to understand it, you know. There's a little sign, a couple of signs on the wall in Shivers, and they came from within, which says that sex was the invention of a clever venereal disease. That was the line. If you try to see sex from the point of view of the AIDS virus, it's a strange little mental twist to do, but it can be done.
Well, I regret that we're out of time. I thank you so very much for talking with us.
Well, it's been a pleasure. Thank you.